This podcast is brought to you by Ramsden Recruitment. It's episode 14 of Chefs on the Pass, the Craft Guild of Chefs official podcast. Let's go! And with competition season once again upon us in the form of National Chef of the Year and Young National Chef of the Year, it felt like the perfect time to bring in David Mulcahy, legend of the judging chamber, and April Partridge, legend of competition, to share their experiences of the culinary competition world. We chat about the challenges and rewards of competing and why it's all about the journey, not just the win. Plus, David shares a sneak peek into a new initiative, and April offers some absolute gold for anyone considering stepping into the competition kitchen. So make sure you hit that subscribe button and come right on in. Hello and welcome to Chefs on the Pass, the Craft Guild of Chefs official podcast, hosted as ever by me, Phil Street. Now then, we are in the midst of competition season. And, well, it was only this week, in fact, that the 40 semi-finalists for the National Chef of the Year were announced. As this goes out, that will be about 3 weeks ago. But a competition which is today considered to be one of the most prestigious in the UK culinary scene. So we, of course, had last year's winner, Ori Shand, on the show back in episode 5. But today we're going to do something a little different, a joint chat with a legend from within the judges' side of things and a legend from within the young National Chef side of things. An all-round battled, hardened competition chef, and that is none other than David Mulcahy and Ape Partridge.
Hello.
Hi, Phil. Hi.
How are we doing?
Good, thanks.
Excellent. Where do we find you both today? David, I'll start with you.
I'm in what is actually sunny, Cambridgeshire. A little village outside Cambridge.
Very nice. I think it's sunny everywhere in the whole of the world right now.
I heard somebody say that apparently London's hotter than the Bahamas right now. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm quite gullible, but I'd still prefer to be
in the Bahamas, I think.
God, honestly, it's gross. Not the Bahamas, this weather.
Yeah, indeed. And where are you based out of, April?
Not the Bahamas. I'm in Fulham right now.
Fulham?
In my little flat, sat drinking some water, talking to you.
Very good. Excellent. Well, I suppose let's just kick things off very, very simply by tell us a little bit about yourself. Again, I'll come back to you, David, just to give us your kind of snapshot overview of your life and times.
Oh, my goodness.
In
2 seconds. Obviously, I've been in and around the world of catering for all of my life. And for the purposes of this, really, just kind of drawing from, you know, lots of experience in food and food service and everything, you know, connected to food is all about, for me, you know, the idea of developing people, training development in food and kind of weaving into having picked up the running of National Chef of the Year about 20 odd years ago now, and just have evolved it hopefully over the years to be what it is today. I'm very passionate about it.
Very good. I mean, there's obviously a lot more stuff that we could talk about with your career and judging experience. Well, we'll talk about some of your judging experience as we get into the conversation in any case. But much appreciate you making time to chat. Very interested to hear, actually, from the judges' side, because that's not something that we ever talk a lot about. So, yeah, we'll see what you've got to say on that. And April, what are you up to these days?
I'm currently the head of development for Opus Provisions. So a little bit of a different route for me from what I've done. I spent the last 15 years in Michelin star restaurants and some of the best restaurants across the world. But yeah, I just sort of fancy doing something different. I think my health was taking a bit of a toll and listened to my body for the first time in my life and was like, okay, I need to just take a little bit of a step in a different direction to move forward, take a bit of time to get myself back on track. And yeah, I used to, well, one of my favourite chefs I've ever worked for was Matt Hewlett, who was my head chef at Ledbury pre-COVID. And he has a company called Opus Provisions, where they supply super yachts with like the most incredible produce you could. I mean, some of the produce I'm seeing is the best stuff I've ever seen in my career. So it's a real, real privilege to be able to see these ingredients and sort of, you know, have a relationship in a different way with suppliers. And yeah, I think I just really want to work for Matt and somebody I really, really look up to and respect. And yeah, it's good. It's different, but I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying doing something a little bit different for now. So yeah, it's good.
That's really cool, yeah. And it also kind of highlights that, I mean, there's so many different directions you can take a life of a chef in.
Oh, 100%. It's not just restaurants. There's loads and loads and loads of things that you can do. But I definitely, and I would say that I'm a, I don't know what the word is for this, I'm a
legend.
I don't know what the word is, but like I definitely when I was like, right, I'm gonna take this job. It sounds super interesting and everything. I felt a huge amount of eyes on me, and you know, the worry of what people would think. I've gone from working in a 3-star restaurant and some of these, you know, some most amazing places in the world, to doing something which nobody expected. And it's probably taken me 6 months to kind of be like, okay, just doesn't, I mean, I care a lot what people think, but it's taken me a long time to be like, okay, just, it doesn't matter what other people think right now. Like, I know in my heart, I know this is the right thing. And, you know, I had to really trust my gut and make a decision, which, you know, I believe is the right decision right now. And yeah, go with it. And hopefully, I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with this, really. I'm just battling this
wobbling. I think to Phil's point, it's like it's the whole industry is so diverse. You can literally pick on any point of it and make a huge success of it. And that's just brilliant, you know, literally, you know. And chances are, April, there's people looking at you going, crikey, that sounds super exciting. I'd love to get involved in that. They're not looking at you as like you've gone into one thing from another, or because we've all done that, you know. And we all kind of feel a little bit at times, a little bit of imposter syndrome or something going on, you know, and you think, crikey.
Oh, I've got absolute crippling imposter syndrome.
Yeah, but actually, there's no need for it. It's ourselves beating ourselves up, and actually, it's fine. So, yeah.
I think
yeah.
It's good.
See, you just can't trust help that. Yourself, can you, David? So just go into the mentor mode.
That's
what it's entails. He's a good mentor, yeah. Though. So it's good.
Yeah. But actually, April, you raise a cracking point. Like, you know, you've gone to work with Matt, you said. Was it Matt? Matt or Mark?
Yeah, Matt Hewlett. He's absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
He was, and... he was at the Fat Duck previously for like many, many years, and he was head chef at Ledbury. And I think I really, forgetting the fact that he was a brilliant chef, what I loved was his approach. And I think that's what really sort of drew me to work with him again, is that, you know, kitchens can be really tough and you can work with all different sorts of personalities. And it's really important to work with people that are all different. So you can try and figure out what, you know, and that's why competitions are great as well, is that you're up against lots of different personalities and you can kind of figure out, take little bits from each one and be like, how do I want to lead? How do I want to work? And I definitely think that Matt has an approach which I really, really appreciate and I really love. And there's so many things that I can learn from him. And that's what it comes down to as well, is like following your gut, that, you know, if you believe something's the right decision, just because it might not be the right decision in everybody else's eyes, it's all about learning, isn't it? It's all about growth. And if you can see something that you can improve on, then you just got to go with the way you're feeling, fully gut.
Yeah, totally. And also, you know, there's absolute merit in, you know, figuring out the type of people that you want to work with. You know, that's a major part of this as well. It's not just about the bones of the job itself. It's about, you know, the people that you're going to be spending all this time with. So, you know, you've got to feel like you are part of them and that you all get each other, and, you know, so it's a great place to be.
Yeah, definitely.
Good stuff. Right. Well, let's get into competition, because you've got varying experience of this. So just going to ask you both a very, very open question to kick things off. What is it about competition that still excites you today?
I think that competitions are brilliant for, well, we're talking about chefs right now, but I think they're brilliant just to really challenge yourself. I think that the worst thing you can do is become complacent and, you know, think that you're doing a great job. I think when you're constantly putting yourself in positions where you're having to, you know, be in gnarly situations where you have to question yourself a little bit and you have to improve and you've got people saying, actually, that's not quite good enough, or you can do better. That's how people really, really improve, is by being in situations that, you know, really challenge them. I think that's what competitions are great for. And I think that for anyone that does a competition, it's really not about the winning. It's about, and that sounds really cliche, but it is really about the journey. It's about the people you meet. And, you know, I failed so much. I think it's funny that you said I was like a legend in the Young National Theatre, because I didn't win it. I would say that I was absolutely not a legend, 100% not a legend. I could tell you the legends. That's like Luke Selby, you know, like he's a bloody legend, you know, even in the competition world. But, I'd say that, like, if I didn't lose as many times as I lost, I wouldn't be the person that I am today. And through all of the trials and tribulations, I am proud of the way that I've handled myself over the years and my, you know, how I've sort of got back up. And I think that maybe that's what people resonate with me, is it's never been about the winning. It's about, you know, just don't give up, just keep trying, and there'll be lessons in everything that you do, and the lessons are what makes you, you know, great.
You know? Love that. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think somebody once said to me, you're going to lose more than you'll win in your life. So you might as well get used to losing.
Yeah.
So this makes you sound like a loser now. You've gone from legend to loser.
No, I am a loser. That's all right. I am a loser, and that's fine. I've embraced it.
No, but there's also an awful lot of people who are not taking part in things like this, right? So you know, nobody can sit from the sidelines and kind of point fingers at anybody who puts themselves, you know, up for this, because this is, as you say, this is going to stretch you. This is going to take you down places that you probably didn't know about yourself, and in the meantime, you're going to learn an awful lot, maybe about cooking, but you know, a lot more about yourself.
It's much harder to put yourself in the spotlight than to sit back. Do you know what I mean? It's hard putting yourself in for these competitions because it's not necessarily the pressure that you feel from other people. It's the pressure you put on yourself. And that's what I found from all the competitions that I've done, is that I felt a lot of pressure from the people supporting me, but the amount of pressure I put on myself was absolutely insane. But I think that it's, you know, it's much harder to put yourself out there. And I respect anybody that will put themselves out there, whether it's once, twice or three times, because you know, there's a lot more people that lose than win, and there's a lot more chance of disappointment than success. And it takes a lot. It shows a lot of, you know, I think resilience is one of the greatest characters you can have as a person. I think anybody going in for this competition is, you know, it shows a lot, and it's great. It's amazing.
Yeah. And what about you, David? Because how many years have you been involved with this now?
Well, as I said, it's a little over 20. I'm probably scaling it down a bit because it makes me sound older.
A little over 20, but actually 30.
Yeah. But again, you know, I think that the fact that, you know, like April said, really, but I guess for me as well, you know, what keeps you excited? Because it would be easy not to be excited by the repetition every year of this, what could appear to be the same thing. But, you know, as April and others know, that every year there's a tweak or a difference or something that changes. And sometimes that comes along, you know, like COVID, and it forces change, or moving venues. You know, way back, National Chef of the Year was biannual. So it was every 2 years. So it took 2 years commitment for somebody to enter. And as we know in the industry, often you don't know where you're going to be in 2 years. So the idea of even beginning to commit means that you feel you either got to stay in the same place, or you hope to be, you know, in the same place or be supported 2 years later. That's a long time in a chef's life. And, you know, just changing that alone was a big deal, because it meant a lot of change, but it was the right thing to do. So, and actually what it does then, it brings a new level of excitement in, because you're almost continually starting the journey, literally. As soon as you get through all the different stages, you get to the final. It's the back end of the year. The minute that's over, within 2 weeks, you're having a wash-up meeting, you're having a planning meeting, and you're off again. And in between running it, like right now this year and next year, also making notes of things you'll do differently and changes you'll make. So it doesn't stop. It's just literally like it's running a business. You know, what is it that's going to keep people excited and fresh, etc.? And I think the thing that any competition, if it's done well, it has that element of excitement about it. It has a huge amount of trust behind it, because otherwise it's nothing. But ultimately for the people involved and competing, and we all competed, and certainly 20, 30 years ago, whatever, you know, it was a different ball game. When you competed, you didn't get the same attention. You didn't get the same, I think, level of probably feedback and support and understanding. So it felt not necessarily as rewarding all the time. You know, you entered it for the right reason, but somewhere along the journey, sometimes there was like, I didn't, you know, there'll be people who say, I entered a competition, I never entered again because the experience was awful. And you think, well, what made that experience awful? Because you simply cooked a dish that you thought was worthy of showing. That's it. And you wanted to be looked at and you know, told what was good and what was bad, etc. And we see it, you know, right down through, you know, as April knows, having been a future chef way back, you know, whether you're a 12-year-old or a 16-year-old, you know, in future chef, or you're an exec chef, you know, in a Michelin-starred environment, anyone can enter a competition. And there are different, you know, competitions there to help you develop. And if you can develop, become better, stronger, you know, again, as April said, you know, resilience is absolutely key. You should come through and out the other side and go, even win, lose, whatever, go, that was a positive experience for whatever reason. And that's what keeps me excited about it, to be part of that and to kind of play that part. And
Yeah, well, you know, you and I haven't known each other very long, but the times that we've had conversations together, I can feel that you really care about this. You know, like, but it's not even so much about the caring aspect of being a judge for something like this. It's about you kind of look at this as that you have a level of responsibility to create an experience for these people, you know, regardless of the feedback that you're giving the contestants.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've inherited something which has, you know, over 50 odd years of legacy, and my job, or the job I've assumed, really, I suppose, on this is, you know, if you're going to own it and you know, and evolve it and grow it and develop it and hopefully take all of the positive and the criticism and everything that comes along with trying to make something better and just do your best. And yeah, and I think, you know, fingers crossed, keep trying.
Yeah.
So for another 50 years.
Well, and they keep asking you back as well. So you must be doing something right. April, to you, take us back to the very first competition that you ever did. What made you say yes in the first place? Or did somebody just say, you're doing that, go?
No, I was 15 and I'd done my work experience and I was super fussy. I had no interest in food. I was like, thought I wanted to be an artist or a musician or a basketball player. I don't know the things I was interested in at the time. But I ended up doing 2 weeks in food, just do something different. My dad was a chef and I used to, although I was a fussy eater, I used to love coming back home and, you know, having delicious food on the table. You know, you'd know when my stepdad was cooking because you'd come back from school and you'd smell a slow roasted, you know, shank of lamb that had been cooking for 6 hours in the oven. It was just amazing. So I thought I'd just do something different. I really fell in love with food and we used to have to get this, like, I don't know what it's called, like a little diary or something that they would write back. And I went back to school and they said, like, she's a real natural, you should get her to pursue this. And they were like, look, did you enjoy it? And I said, you know what, I actually really enjoyed it and I didn't think I would. And they said, well, would you like to go in for this competition? And it was a real, you know, completely on a whim. I said, yeah, actually, I will. Why not? I had no fear. You know, looking back now, I wasn't afraid of it because it just seemed like a great opportunity to cook and I was really enjoying it those previous 2 weeks. And my stepdad mentored me and I cooked, you know, he taught me how to cook a beautiful bed of chicken and how to make classic risotto and how to set a panna cotta and, you know, real basic things. And I just fell in love with it, really. So it was a real spare of the moment thing. I don't know what the word is for it, but I think I just really enjoyed this couple of weeks. Thought, yeah, do you know what, I'll have a go. And then doing the competition, really, it opened up a door for me to have a Saturday job. And the more time I spent in the kitchen, I fell in love with it. And there was just no turning back for me. It was a real fell in love. First time I fell in love was in the kitchen.
Very good. Wow. Everybody falls in love with food in the end.
That's it.
But do you know, Phil, I mean, just even listening to that, and obviously, you know, having been involved in Future Chef since day one, which is quite a few years ago now.
More than five.
Yeah, well, you know, we're kind of heading quickly towards 30 years. And that was an idea that at the time, Anne Pierce, Brian Turner, and myself and a couple were sitting down in a room saying, wouldn't it be great to find a way to get into schools to share the idea of a life skill? That was it. It was like, could that work? And Future Chef was born. And we thought, give it a go, see what happens. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And, you know, as I say, you know, now we have 16,000 or so kids taking part every year.
Amazing,
it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And to April's point, and the thing that's really important in that is these kids come in and by the time they've gone through that year or, you know, a couple of terms, by the time they get through to maybe potentially a final or even right through to local heats and regional heats, etc., each step they've grown and developed and they've improved their lives. And when you see them at the final and you know, it's like, it's an incredible feeling looking at these youngsters who have no baggage. They just do as they're asked, you know, and it's probably a lesson about, you know, being a young chef, the idea that if you're given good, credible advice and follow it, there'll be success in terms of the dish that comes out of that. And that's rewarding. I mean, you know, you just hear April saying that, you know, the idea of setting a panna cotta or making a risotto or whatever, it's more than basics because so many people can't do it. So it's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's crazy as well. Like going back to that briefly, like the amazing idea that you guys had to do that in that it's funny how my perspective's changed and my goals as I've got older, in that you'd asked me 5 years ago what my goal was. It would be, I wanted to have my own restaurant. I wanted to have a Michelin star. It was completely focused on that. And now, as I've got older, my views completely changed. And, you know, somebody said to me the other day, they said to me, like, what do you want to leave behind as your legacy? And it was so easy for me to answer. And it wasn't about having my own restaurant and being a Michelin star chef. It's that what I would love is, I would love to almost not finish what Jamie Oliver started, because he's still doing it and he's doing like an unbelievable job. But I want, you know, every single child in the country to be able to cook. I think that it's so important. I don't know why we're teaching kids how to, you know, do algebra and stuff. Yeah. And they can't, like you said, they cannot cook. They end up going to university and they're eating super noodles. And we're in this generation where kids don't know how to cook. You know, obesity is at a high, the NHS are stretched, and it's absolutely mental. And it's like, I would love to be part of something where I could make it mandatory that every single child in the UK learns how to cook. And I'm not talking about the cooking that I had to do when I was at school, which was making fruit salad or making a rock cake that you could throw at your enemy and it would knock them out. Do you know what I mean? It's like, that's basics. Not cooking. And it's like David said, let's teach them how to, you know, make an omelette. Let's teach them how to cook pasta properly and basic life skills. Because you would end up having a way richer hospitality industry, because kids would fall in love with food. I think it would enrich the industry so much.
It's, and just a healthier, like, society.
It honestly baffles me. It's like so simple. Like, I just don't understand why that's not a thing. It's mental. Yeah. Anyway, now, don't get me on that, because I'll just go on a tangent and I'll just be chatting and chatting about this, because I'm really passionate about it. But
Given us a topic for a future podcast discussion, I think. But because I 100% agree with you. Like, I think, you know, people forget sometimes that food, we need it to live, you know. 100%. So, you know, it doesn't, you're not having to churn out restaurant quality food every night, but you can churn out something that's delicious and simple in, you know, 15 minutes and fresh. You know, it's the I don't know where it's all come from. Anyway, but that, as I say, we could probably all rant about that, to be honest.
You've got to pull this back to competitions now, Phil.
Indeed. Back to you, David. In your experience, what's the real magic of culinary competitions? I mean, there's so many things that spring to mind, but I won't kind of put anything in your head. What still is, you know, when every year when you finish a competition, you kind of go home with this, your heart full. What is it that does that to you?
Okay, I think, well, there's a lot. I suppose on one level, it's just, you know, having put something together each year that has its own criteria, its own structure, seeing, you know, the, I guess that the kind of everyone from the competitors to the judges to the kind of media and the noise around it kind of pulling together and coming together makes it all feel worthwhile. I think back to some of the things we've already said, you know, the fact that anyone can enter from any sector, from any background, in any environment, and get the same level of treatment is important. And that drives me, because it's really important that that's clear and transparent. I suppose the fact that, you know, I think somebody, you'd mentioned maybe another thing, Phil, we were talking about camaraderie and things like that. And that whole idea that people that are competing for a title, for example, but not necessarily competing against each other. You know, maybe April agrees or disagrees, but I think, you know, your biggest competitor is yourself. You know, you've got to get your head into it. You've got to get yourself straight. There's only, in some cases, if we're honest with ourselves, sometimes we don't do so well at something because we actually haven't done all the work required. And there's times when it just doesn't work on the day. And, you know, there's luck plays a part. You know, sometimes you'll see somebody arriving and they own it. They absolutely nail it. And it's something about that focus, you know, that on another day, you know, somebody else rises to the top and owns it. And it's not just owning it for part of a competition, it's the whole piece all the way through. So, and I think there's something strong about, you know, the idea that you've got all these past competitors of, in this case, National Chef of the Year, who are all part of a family. They've all been through some shade of that competition. And I think that's brilliant. It's magical to have that kind of link with each other, even if you don't know each other, and that respect for each other, particularly from sectors that maybe don't jump to the top all the time, don't get the recognition they get all the time, that somebody doing really well is like, oh, hang on a sec, there's another part to this industry. And I think that's what April started with, is like going from one side to another side of the industry. And, you know, I think it gives it credibility. So I think that's a broad part of it. And just finally on that, I think really just to kind of say, because of all of that, we're and one of the changes this year, our introductions, is we're just about to launch the National Chef of the Year alumni program. And that really is to harness the past competitors of National Chef. And we're kind of starting with a couple of stages. So the idea is for the past 6 years, we're going to pick the top, the finalists, essentially all finalists, and start that group as a bit of a, you know, a group that can get involved in terms of shaping the future, in terms of feedback, in terms of judging, etc., and being those ambassadors that they already are, but give a bit of recognition for it. And I think it's something that, you know, kind of wanted to do for a little while. So there's a hot off the press. We're just launching the alumni. And I think April should be the very first member, by the way. I think that would be.
Amen.
There you go.
You need a winner.
No, that's the point. That's the point of this. The alumni isn't about just an elite group of winners. And to be honest, National Chef isn't about that elitism. It's about everybody kind of, you know, that played that part. Yeah. Doing what they can to support.
Well, I think going back to what you said there about, like, if on the day somebody's like shining and on another day they might not have been, I think that plays a huge factor in it, that you do just need like a little bit of luck on your side that day. Like 100%. I think that plays a huge factor. Like, you just need a little bit of luck, a bit of pixie dust blown in the wind on your, do you know what I mean? And sometimes it's going to be a day and sometimes it's not. And yeah.
But you know what? The thing about that for me is this is where I hadn't really contemplated this until we had Ori on the show last year, is that actually, do you know what? A lot of this can, it might be a competition, but you can also kind of just reflect your day to day in the stuff that happens in competition. You know, are you just a bit off? That can happen in your regular life. Does the equipment not work the way you want it to? That can happen, you know, in a kitchen environment that you're completely familiar with. There's all manner of stuff that just happens. And just because it's a competition, actually, then you can mirror that in, you know, just your general day-to-day shift at work.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's how we talk about how you recover. You know, it's not the problem you have, but how you recover. And it sounds cliche, but it's not, because, you know, you're the only one that's in your own head. And you know exactly what you want to get on that plate or, you know, through that menu. And the judges often are the ones just waiting to receive that. You know, they're like, okay, what are we to look forward to? So if something is slightly positioned differently or missing, it depends on how big a problem that missing bit is. But, you know, there's areas where you think, yeah, you're in control, you know. And if you act in control as well, I think, you know, kind of step into that, it shows a level of confidence as opposed to arrogance. Confidence, which is important. Yeah,
absolutely. And by the way, for the record, April, congratulations on being alumni number one.
Thank you. As my election, I'd like to say that Otto, my cat, is the unofficial mascot of the alumni. You've heard it here first.
Well, people can't see what we can see, but Otto has already joined us for the conversation today, which is great. That's life. That's what happens these days on live calls. Well, it's not live, but anyway. Let's talk about stuff that people maybe misunderstand about competitions. So, and we can look at this from both sides of the coin. I'll come back to you again, David, from the judges' side of things. What do people misunderstand about culinary competitions?
I suppose, well, as a competitor, sometimes when you step into, when you decide, I think I might want to enter that, sometimes the misunderstanding is the level of work required. You know, it may appear to be quite simple on the outset, but there's no way, really, that without practicing and without really understanding and getting your head straight, you know, that you're going to do as well as you could do. So there's a bit of, and I think you see that sometimes with chefs that compete, don't do so well, come back again, have learned that, and then come back and go, right, now I get it better. I understand a bit better. So there's a bit of that. And the other side, probably from a misunderstanding, is probably, and again, that's probably years ago more than now, that there used to be a sense that the competition itself was a bit of a dark art. You know, there was, you're never quite sure how judging was happening, how it was taking place, and how above board and straight it was, and were you competing to the right requirements? You know, did you know the marking criteria and what you should, boxes you needed to tick? And that has changed a lot. You know, there's a lot of feedback and a lot of conversation and a lot of questions and a lot of friendliness, you know, among that group that I didn't see when I, you know, started way back and started competing. That wasn't there. You just daren't ask, and that was the way it is. So I think that's helped. And the other thing, I suppose, is the fact that the judges themselves, and we know many of them as, you know, fairly senior people in the industry and highly respected, they don't give up their time easily for something that they don't want their name to be attached to, and do it well, and do it honestly, etc. So there is that. They're invested as much as the competitor, and that's important. So I think, you know, all of that should mean that, you know, the misunderstanding should be quickly put aside. And of course, the other thing is that, you know, we go to great lengths to write a criteria and give hints and tips in that criteria, which are quite explicit, you know, to say, if you follow this and here's some tips and here's some guidance, you should be in a better place. And then feedback is key, you know, and, you know, sometimes you can't give enough feedback, but we try. So, yeah, so there's a few things there that hopefully will help people who might want to try to compete and just not sure if they'll have everything that they need to hand. We help a lot. I think, you know, I don't know, April, if you agree, but I think Chef of the Year helps and guides and has a way of probably feedback and different at different levels and different, you know, every single chef that didn't get through this week has been written to, has had a synopsis of feedback from every judge so that they're clear. Now they can take that and say, well, that's I don't amazing. Believe in that and I don't agree that, but you know what, that's for them to kind of go, okay, and to sit back and look at it and go, is there something in here that would help me if I go again, you know? And that's really important, because years ago, certainly if you didn't get through, you just got no feedback, you know?
Right.
Well, we want them back, we want chefs back, because the difference between getting it right and getting it wrong sometimes is a tiny, tiny thing, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Same question to you, April, from the competitor's side of things.
No, I think definitely what you said there about like feedback, I think that maybe there is this misconception that if you don't get through, like, I mean, that's definitely amazing. I didn't know that, you know, if you didn't get through this year, that you'd get a little bit of information from everybody. I think that's really fantastic. I think it makes people feel valued and, you know, that they haven't just given up their time for nothing and that they can still learn something from it. And I definitely think that the misconception is that you've got to win to succeed. Like I said before, some of the best lessons I learned were not, I'd say all of the best lessons I've ever learned from being in the kitchen have been from the hardest days, whether it's, and I would say that, you know, although I never won Young Chef of the Year or National Chef of the Year, every time that I came back, I believed I was a better cook. And I believe that I walked into the kitchen with more confidence and that I was more proud than I had been the year before. And if there was, you know, times when something hadn't gone right, I didn't sit back and say, well, I don't think it's fair. I'd sit back and look at the person that won and think, like, what have they got that's better than me? Like, how can I be that good? Or how can I improve? And I think that it does sound really cliche because it's not about the win. Obviously, if you win, it's absolutely banging. It's amazing. But it's the journeys that come with it. And it's, you know, how often will you have the opportunity to cook for your heroes? I mean, I still to this day would say that the greatest compliment that I ever had was, I think, one of the first years I ever competed. I think I was in the Young Chef. I made this like lemon dessert. And Phil Howard came up to me and he said, that was absolutely delicious. And that was the greatest compliment. Still to this day, like, if I had ever won in National Chef of the Year, I would have wanted Phil Howard to be my judge, because I've got the most utmost respect, because he just is the most wonderful cook. And I don't think that people really acknowledge the fact that even just competing, you literally get to have an interaction with some of your, you know, dream chefs and your heroes that, I mean, you wouldn't necessarily get in another situation. And that opportunity doesn't come lightly. And I don't think people should take it for granted, you know, even them just, you know, giving you a little bit of feedback, it will make you come back stronger. And like you said, reevaluate things in the kitchen. Maybe there's something that I'm not so good at that I can go back to. And, you know, I've met some amazing judges over the years that I've met through, for example, Nash Chef of the Year, like Jockey. Like, Jockey judged me many times. And I would like to say that he's a friend now. If I see him, I give him the biggest hug, we catch up, and somebody that I hugely respect. But if I hadn't gone into competitions, I wouldn't have made a lot of the connections I have made. And so I think it's like, yeah, I mean, you've got to be in it to win it. Like, you've got nothing to lose and everything to gain from being in a competition.
Yeah, and these are the things that maybe people don't think about, you know, is that actually the people that you meet along the way is also part of the journey. And you never know when these people are going to become a bigger part of your life, whether that is one of the judges who you end up working for or as a colleague one day, or whether it's just another competitor that you just hit it off with and, you know, all of a sudden you're cooking together somewhere, you know, in the future. Sure. Who knows, right? I mean, that's the beauty of connection. Mm-hmm. You can't, I mean, the Phil Howard thing, I can relate to because Phil's awesome. I've been lucky enough to interview him as well. He's just a really gracious guy who's been there, done it, seen it all, good and bad, which he's very open about as well, which is great. But kind of like that leads me on to the next question, basically, which is all around that those kind of goosebump moments that you get. Can you remember, David, from the judging side, does this happen quite often when you kind of, because you must see people grow through competitions, and I imagine that must be quite a wonderful experience.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of moments in a competition, you know, kind of, I suppose, whether they're favourite moments or just poignant, you know, you tend to see people kind of laid bare, you know, they're so focused and they're so committed and they desperately want to do their best, and you can see it on them, you know, you can just feel it sometimes. And sometimes, you know, somebody will arrive or become very stressed or very emotional, you know, and that's kind of, and you just want to kind of, you know, take them aside and just say, just breathe, it's going to be okay, you know. But so there's always that kind of human thing more and more now, I think. But I think when, certainly if you're standing in a kitchen and there's 10 chefs cooking their absolute hearts out, just watching, there's a point that comes in the competition where everything's in full flow, you know, everything's going. The judges are focusing on what somebody's doing. They're kind of looking intently at that competitor in different parts of the kitchen. The chefs are head down. They're probably watching clocks and timers and everything else going on, you know, going, just thinking, right, you know, and you can feel that there's almost that point before takeoff, you know, where it's just at its absolute optimum. And that's a brilliant feel. That's a brilliant view of what this, you know, culinary world is about. So I think that's hugely important, and that gives you kind of, you want everyone to win, you want everybody to be doing their absolute best and getting there. So so that's important. And the other bit probably is in the judges room, you know, when you're thrashing out marks and debating and things like that, and you know, I suppose sometimes playing referee at times and various things like that.
Does it get heated?
Do you know, not so much in recent years, but certainly way back, very heated would be
really?
Short answer.
Right.
You know,
right.
Very, you know, certain individuals. But I think also it's, you learn then, okay, maybe let's help brief the judges slightly differently. Let's break them into groups to judge one course each as opposed to the whole thing. Let's, you know, make sure they judge independently. And you know, there's a whole bunch of things like this that you can start to introduce. And you end up then with really good conversations from each group of judges around, you know, because every mark we challenge is like, well, why did you mark high there, low there? What did somebody not see? What did somebody see? So there's a lot of interrogation, or potentially a lot of interrogation. So that kind of, that, you know, becomes quite, you're waiting for that white smoke to come out at the end. And of course, you know, making sure you've got the right winner on the basis that the marks are often so close, you know, there's tiny, tiny, minute marks in the difference, and not just from first and second, but third and fourth is important as well. Now, who gets that third place? It's important, and why? So all of that becomes a bit goosebumpy, as you kind of said. And then just generally how the winners react. You know, sometimes when a winner, particularly when they've given their all, and there's nothing else to give, and they feel that they may not have given enough. And you know that they're about to win and they don't know that. And that's something kind of incredible, because equally, everybody in that room deserves to be there and deserves to be on the podium. And for whatever reason, you know, some aren't. So, yeah, so that's a goosebump moment. And very finally, I think, because it reminds me of April all the time, is during COVID when we did the online judging for the very first time, April, and you were sitting, I think, outside on a little seat, and you were talking about, was it an eel dish that your dad used to take you to have, or it was something, and you described your kind of father and growing up with food and things like that. And it was highly emotional. Phil Howard rang me as well, saying, what are you doing to us? Because they were all watching the videos, you know, independently. And they were like, oh my goodness, like, you learn so much from a person by some of their history and what they've done. So it's lots of moments.
Yeah, yeah, I couldn't imagine. You've sold it well. How do people get involved in being a judge, by the way? Is that do you have to get asked, or can people ask?
Yeah, there's two ways, I suppose. I mean, we I started introducing a chair of judges a number of years ago to start to kind of harness some of that. So they would work together to say, right, you know, do they have some preferences in terms of judges that they think should be there? Because it's all about the status as well. And then I tend to look at it for each stage. There's different skill sets required. So for the paper entry, you want somebody who is a real detailed person. And for the final, you want somebody who's highly visual and highly intuitive. So there's sometimes we won't ask a paper judge to be a judge in the final at all. And that's not because they're not good enough. It's just because, A, it takes a lot of time out for them. And if you ask somebody to do three things, they're likely to say no to all of them. If you say to do one thing, they're likely to say yes. So there's that. Now, sometimes those judges would say, oh, you know, if you need somebody for the final or for a second stage or something, please give us a shout. And then you look at it and you think, right, what's the skills I need here? You know, how do we get a real fair balance across the board? And they're there for their honesty and integrity, really.
Yeah, absolutely. April, to you, looking back, if you could give yourself, your younger self, one tip before stepping into the competition kitchen, what would it be?
Probably not to put as much pressure on myself. I think that I've spent my career being my worst enemy and just putting like an insane amount of pressure and saying horrible things to myself when I didn't win or, you know, didn't feel like I was good enough. So I'd probably say just enjoy the ride a little bit more and, you know, it'll all work out in the end.
Very good. A little sigh at the end sentence says everything.
It's been a long day.
Oh, bless you. And David, from a judging perspective, in terms of when people put up a plate of food, I guess this is very, very specific to the brief that you've set. But what are you really looking for in terms of anybody who's listening to this now, who is maybe about to, who's maybe one of the 40, who is about to embark on this, you know, the front end of this journey? You know, what are you really looking for from that individual?
Crikey. I suppose when they put a plate of food up, I suppose it's important to say it's not just about the food that they put up. It's April used the word journey at the beginning of, I think, of this podcast, and I think that's important. You know, the journey of the actual 3 hours of competition is important. How they conducted themselves, how they worked, all of that comes into it strongly. Of course, right at the end, there's going to be, is this dish amazing? Is it full of flavor? You know, is it well balanced? Is it seasoned? It's all the kind of basics, really. But, you know, what you really want is at the outset, when they look at the criteria, that they really take time to dig deep into that criteria. Almost read it and read it and read it and read it. Highlight words, asterisk words, write them down in their own language, whatever, because there are literally hints within that. You know, if somebody's saying, focus on provenance, focus on food waste, focus on seasonality, it sounds whatever, you know, focus on the time of year that you're going to be cooking. And then somebody writes a menu that's so out of season because when they're cooking is going to be 3 seasons later or 2 seasons later, it has a bit of a backward step. And you're like, it's a great dish, but white asparagus won't be available or strawberries, it's out of season. And it sounds, and they know that. And they go, oh, crikey, I would have replaced that. And of course they would. But those that didn't do that have to be marked higher because they got it, you know. So there's a bit of that. It's like read and really understand it. That's important. But once that plate comes up, or once, you know, that they go through that kind of competition, I think you can see the passion and the knowledge and the deep investment that somebody's making in their dishes, because it's them, you know, they're literally coming from a place that they believe. And it, do you know what? It wouldn't matter if that dish at the end of it wasn't a judge's favorite or wasn't their style. That shouldn't matter, because that's, you know, again, we try to encourage and make sure the judges are objective, not subjective. So that shouldn't come into it. It's like, what do they try to achieve? Do they achieve what they set out to do? Did they nail it? And at the end of the day, then, does it fit, you know, into that cuisine or style? And is it delicious? And, you know, back to Phil Howard, I mean, his whole thing all the time is just make it delicious. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. Phil Howard and his God-given palate. Those were the words he used, but he is correct. Final question then, and this is kind of to both of you, I suppose, from your own perspectives, but would you recommend competing to other young chefs, and what's your pitch to them if they're kind of sitting on the fence about it? I'll come to you, April, first.
100%. I think that, you know, I mean, I guess I could I don't know, I've lived my whole life doing competitions and, you know, put myself out there, and it's not always been the most comfortable position, but it's really helped me to grow, and not even as a chef, but I feel like I've really grown as a person. And that's also what competitions give you. Like, it gives you a sense of camaraderie and, you know, a sense of unity. And it's exactly sort of what David said earlier, that, you know, you can be in a room with, you know, 10 people, 20 people, however many people you're competing against. And although you want to win so badly, you also really want other people to do well. And I think that, you know, there's definitely been times over the years, especially when I was, you know, in the younger heats, where I look and I think, oh my God, like, I remember being so busy, but seeing somebody was struggling and their blender broke or their oven broke, and I would be like, no, just come and use mine, come and use mine. And I look back now and I wouldn't change a thing, because, you know, that's who I am. You know, I think that's really important. And you figure out who you are in the kitchen, what sort of person you are. It's nothing to lose, everything to gain. You can only get better. It opens amazing windows and avenues for you to work with incredible people, meet suppliers, see what you're up against. You know, what are your peers doing? Who's better than you? Why are they better than you? Who do you really admire? How, you know, I think what I really love about cooking is when you see somebody that absolutely loves it and is brilliant at it, it's almost like watching a movie. It's actually a really romantic thing. Like, when somebody's cooking and it's effortless, it's the most beautiful thing. And I've really loved competing in competitions for that as well. Just watching other people and the way they cook and the way that everybody is so different and how, you know, their personalities affect the way that they play and their, I don't know. I think like what David said, you can really see somebody in the way they cook and the way that, you know, how confident they are in their style. And like you said, it also gives people an opportunity to not cook the food of their chef. You know, you might be working in a 3-star restaurant and you might love cooking like that, but they're not your dishes, you know, and you come into a competition like that and you're forced to be in a position where you're like, okay, well, now it's my menu. And how can I understand? Because it's really hard when you work in these restaurants to actually understand who you are as a cook. It's really hard to figure out, you know, what is my style? You know, what do I really like? How's my plating style? How's my palate? Is it more punchy? Is it more delicate? Do I like to use vinegars for seasoning? Do I, you know, and I think competitions like this and like you said, really reading between the lines on the brief, they really give you a chance to figure out who you are as a chef and to help you progress personally. Like, I would encourage anyone to do it, and I think you're silly if you don't, to be honest, even if you just do it once.
Very good. Yeah, I mean, top that, David, as a pitch for anybody who might be listening who's on the fence.
Well, it's coming from the horse's mouth, so I think, you know, it's you have to listen to that. I mean, you know, anyone who's competed knows how tough it is and how, you know, how it feels to win or not win. You know, as I think we both said, you know, it strengthens you, it makes you more resilient, it tells others who you are, it tells yourself who you are. And even to the point about cooking other people's food, it's interesting because you're right, in a restaurant, you're there to do a job, you know, for, you know, that's been agreed for a customer kind of thing. But many times over the years, chefs competing in National Chef have, when they've had to compete a number of times before they've won, for instance, they've said that they were cooking what they thought the judges wanted to see, or they were trying to interpret what would impress a judge, and it didn't work. When they cooked their own food in their own way, in their style, because they're naturally more comfortable and more attuned to it, they did better. And there's something about, I think what April was saying, is be yourself. And then to that point, why wouldn't you compete? I mean, my goodness. And also these days, the prizes are great. They were never prizes.
Prize,
you were lucky to get a certificate years ago.
Well done. So, well done.
Yeah. So, do you know, I mean, because we've all been there as well. And it's just, you know, it was almost like the privilege of competing was good enough, you know, to be allowed. So now there's all sorts, and particularly for the younger chefs, if there are workshops and masterclasses and developmental kind of opportunities, grab them. Just grab them, you know, because... Yeah. That's brilliant, you know, that's worth its weight in gold.
Yeah.
And of course, given that we're starting an alumni for National Chef of the Year, why wouldn't you want to be part of the family by having competed? It's great. It's a good family.
No, I'm sold. I'm signing up to next year. I can't cook to that standard, but I'll give it my best. I will cook from my heart. That's for sure.
That's important.
But no, I think I'd prefer to be a judge, to be honest, especially when you said that the second part of the competition is more visual and intuitive. That's right up my alley. I could do that. If you want a layman's palate one day, just knock me up, as it were. Brilliant.
We'll keep that in mind.
Thank you so much, guys. There's loads more that we could talk about, of course, but we're bang out of time. So I absolutely appreciate you making time to have this chat today, and wish you guys, well, I wish you all the best with the judging, David, and I wish you all the best with your new direction, April.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Phil, and thanks, April. And look forward to seeing you soon.
See you soon, guys.
Bye-bye. Well, I can't tell you how awesome it was to spend some time with David and April. It's hard to imagine a more passionate, genuine pair of guests. I always find it fascinating to hear from those who've lived and breathed the competition world, and their stories were full of heart and invaluable insight. What really stood out, though, was the way that both of them spoke about mentorship, personal growth, and the true value of competition in developing resilience and confidence in the kitchen. A massive thank you to David and April for making time for the chat. We'll of course be back with another cracking conversation soon, so until then, look after yourselves, and we'll catch you again the next time.